From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoane with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is off today. Next week, the bar where everybody knows your name closes its doors. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Ken Levine, who's been a writer on the sitcom Cheers on and off since its first season. He even won an Emmy. And as if that wasn't enough of a thrill, at the age of 40, Levine realized his dream of becoming a Major League Baseball announcer. We'll talk about his two careers. Also today, filmmaker Ross McElwee. You may remember his comic personal documentary, Sherman's March, which pondered the existence of romantic love. His new movie, Time Indefinite, picks up where Sherman's March left off. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead fills in for film critic Stephen Schiff. Kevin reviews the new Western, Posse. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has suggested that if necessary, he will force his economic plan through Congress without a single Republican vote. The tax portion of the president's plan cleared the House Ways and Means Committee yesterday, but it faces more opposition in the Senate. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
In a news conference today, President Clinton was defensive about his achievements on Capitol Hill. Referring to Republican opposition to his economic plan, the president said, "Cynicism is the easy path." While Republicans cannot filibuster budget legislation on the floor of the Senate, their opposition on the Senate Finance Committee may force some changes. Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole said today, with the help of at least one Democrat on the committee, Republicans aim to get rid of the energy tax altogether and strike a provision that would expand the amount of Social Security benefits subject to tax. One school of thought, he said, is to let the president have what he wants and see what happens to the economy. But he said the GOP has an obligation to offer an alternative. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Clinton says that he thinks that placing U.N. troops in the border between Bosnia and Serbia is a good idea, but that there are no plans for U.S. troops to take part. Mr. Clinton told a news conference today that he had not decided whether to have American troops join UN peacekeeping forces in Macedonia, but said that he was committed to keeping the fighting from spreading. This time, the president said he does not favor using airstrikes alone, and said that he might look again at his call for lifting an arms ban against Muslims in Bosnia if Serbia did not send more arms to Bosnian Serbs. Meanwhile, the U.S.-led airdrop to eastern Bosnia has delivered close to 4,000 tons of food and relief supplies since flights started in March. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
This past week alone, 383 tons of food and medical supplies were parachuted into Bosnia by U.S., German, and French cargo planes. The humanitarian goods were dropped over encircled Muslim enclaves, such as Šepa and Srebrenica. Since the mission began, the high-flying aircraft had dropped dehydrated, ready-to-eat food and powdered staples, as well as basic medical kits and tents. There have been no reported incidents of attacks on the nightly missions, which start and land at Rhein-Main Air Force Base in Frankfurt. Meanwhile, German Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel visited Croatia today to mediate in the growing conflict between Croatians and Muslims in Bosnia. Kinkel condemned the renewed fighting between the two ethnic groups and warned Croatian leaders they are risking the loss of Western aid. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 5 points to close at 3,443.01 on volume of more than 252 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. In France, a standoff continues at a nursery school near Paris. A gunman has held six youngsters and their teacher hostage for 2 days. At one point today, a van reportedly carrying ransom money drove up to the nursery school. The gunman has demanded $18.5 million. He's holding children ages 3 and 4 and has said that his main motivation is money. Officials say the children have been told by their teacher that it's all a game. In Rome, a powerful bomb has exploded in a residential area of the city, and officials say at least 10 people have been injured. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
The bomb went off in a northern suburb around 9:30 this evening, destroying cars and blowing out the windows of nearby apartment buildings. Police say no one has been killed in the attack, but more than 10 people have been injured, two of them seriously. There's no word yet on the motive for the attack, but it occurred near the studio which hosts a controversial talk show, and the car of the show's host had passed the scene of the explosion just minutes before. A senior magistrate also lives in the area. The car bomb blast comes nearly a year to the day since the mafia attack which killed the leading anti-mafia judge, Giovanni Falcone, in Sicily. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Agreement has been reached in Germany in a pay dispute between workers in eastern Germany and employers. Engineering workers, now on strike, have agreed to delay a pay increase to levels equal to their counterparts in the West until 1996. Unions have agreed to draw up a new pay agreement, taking the place of one that was supposed to go into effect in April, but one that employers failed to comply with. Business leaders said they did not have the money to pay for the increases. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. I'm Ann Taylor, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Next week, the final episode of Cheers will air. My guest, Ken Levine, was one of the original writers on the show. He was also a head writer for MASH and is currently creative consultant for Wings and Cheers and is developing more projects for TV. But none of these accomplishments diminished his boyhood dream of being a play-by-play baseball announcer. So several years ago, as he neared the age of 40, Levine decided that it was time to see if he could make it in the broadcast booth. Based on tapes he made with his own portable tape recorder, he landed an announcer job for a minor league team. And in 1991, he was offered a job with the Baltimore Orioles. Levine kept a diary of that year, which is now a book called It's Gone. No, wait a minute. He'll tell us about that call in just a few minutes. Levine was with the Orioles for only one season, but he was picked up by the Seattle Mariners, where he currently works. Like most people, Ken Levine was introduced to baseball in elementary school.
Really, as a kid growing up, I didn't have much exposure to baseball because I was out in the hinterlands of Los Angeles. And then in 1958, the Dodgers came to town, and that's when I really discovered it, and also discovered Vin Scully, who was their longtime broadcaster. And by the time I was eight, I already knew that I didn't have what it takes to be an athlete. In a sense, that's sort of a gift, because a lot of people wait until they're 20 or 30 to have their hearts broken. And I wanted to be a baseball announcer.
Well, you said that you were, perhaps, the worst outfielder in America?
Oh, yeah, easily.
I
mean,
so
it's unbelievable. I don't have good depth perception, which I probably shouldn't admit being a baseball announcer. But I would stand in the outfield, and there would be a routine pop-up, and I would drift under it, and it would land 5 feet over my head.
Now, you started listening to Vin Scully and play-by-play with your dad. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. My dad really introduced me to it. In fact, my whole family was really into baseball, and I remember as a kid when you're on the West Coast, the games on the East Coast take place about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and we would have dinner listening to baseball games.
Well, what was it about Vin Scully's voice, his demeanor, that really inspired you?
Well, Vin Scully had a tremendous sense of drama. He also had a real great way of communicating the tradition and the history and the lore of the game so that it wasn't just an athletic event. You really got hooked into the whole history of baseball and the tradition of baseball. And I don't know, there's just something about the way he described it. He managed to personalize the players and the situations so that you weren't just following a game night to night. It was almost like following a soap opera on a daily basis. And I really got hooked into the personalities and the rhythms of the game. And also, Vin Scully has a real enthusiasm for the game. There's just something about hearing his voice where you know that he would rather be at the ballpark than anywhere else. And that was transmitted to me. And that's something that I like to take with me as well.
Well, now, were you then, you realized, as you said, at a young age that you were not going to be the ball player you had hoped you would be. When did you really get hooked on this idea of being an announcer?
Well, I thought even at the time when I was 8, 9 years old, I thought, wow, what a great way to spend your life. You get to go around the country to exotic places like Cleveland and Cincinnati and Philadelphia, certainly. And you get to be a part of a baseball team and you get to follow them and watch baseball each and every day. and get paid for it. I thought, this is a great way of making a living. And so even at an early age, I figured this would really be fun to do.
But how did you keep that alive? And many things intervened between that early aspiration and the chance that you got at the Baltimore Orioles.
Right. Well, it's kind of tough to get jobs as announcers. And when I got done with my schooling at UCLA, I decided to go into radio, but as a disc jockey, because although I didn't see how I could pursue sports casting per se, I did fall in love with radio as a result. And I was a disc jockey bouncing around the country from Bakersfield to Detroit. So I got to see all of these exotic places anyway for a few years. And when I got tired of playing Kung Fu fighting four times a night for $650 a month, I figured there had to be something else. And I hooked up with my now writing partner, David Isaacs, who was schlepping film cans at ABC. And the two of us decided to try writing. You know, it's the old story. You look at what's on TV and you say, gee, I could do that. And we sat down and started writing scripts, and that began a career that has lasted 20 years and still going as a television writer. But in the back of my mind, there was still that nagging call to be a baseball announcer. I would go to Dodger games, and I would see Vin Scully sitting up in the booth, and I would think to myself, what if I had taken that path? And so about 6-7 years ago, I decided, you know, it's now or never. And I threw caution and ego to the wind and grabbed a tape recorder and went to the upper deck of Dodger Stadium and just started broadcasting games into the tape recorder just to see if I had any ability in this direction. And I fell in love with doing it. I didn't fall in love with people throwing nachos at my head. but still, it was very intoxicating. And I said, you know, I would love to see what it would be like to actually broadcast baseball. So I sent tapes around to minor league teams and got a job with the Syracuse Chiefs, which is the Toronto Blue Jays AAA affiliate, in 1988. And that was how I began this folly.
Well, how would you say then the difference is broadcasting a minor league team and a major league team?
Well, it's tremendous. You can see in a major league park, first of all, the lighting is good. To be honest with you, it's very similar. It's the same game, and in many ways, it's more fun doing a minor league game because the players are not so absorbed in their contracts and agents and that sort of thing, their endorsement deals. They're really there to play the game, to make it to the big leagues. The ballparks are more intimate. It's easier for the fans to have access to the players and to be spending a warm summer evening, say in Rochester, New York, at a funky old ballpark calling a game is really a great way of spending a day.
Now, how did you actually get the attention of the Baltimore Orioles? And you were their announcer for the 1991 season. And when you got that call to say you're hired, this was, as you say, the end of a lifelong fantasy. What was your reaction?
Well, my first reaction when I was offered the job of the Orioles was elation. I had never imagined that I would actually get to the level of big league broadcasting. And that lasted for a couple of minutes, and then it was replaced with a feeling of overwhelming panic, because it's one thing to be sitting in the upper deck of Dodger Stadium annoying a couple of general admission patrons, and it's another to be broadcasting minor league baseball where you don't have a real big audience, and it's not that much of a factor. If you blow a home run call, so what? But it's another to be the voice of the Baltimore Orioles, to be on a 33-station network that blankets the entire East Coast. It's like, this is for real. This is a real job here. And then there were questions of, was I ready? Was I good enough? That sort of thing. And so for about a day, I was just absolutely in a state of panic.
Well, the title of your book, It's Gone, No, Wait a Minute, actually is a call that you made. What happened?
Yeah, that's my classic home run call. Each announcer should have his own signature home run call, and unfortunately, that's mine. No, I have made that mistake a couple of times. The reality is, if you talk to any major league announcer, Vin Scully, anyone, they will tell you, yes, there have been times when they have blown home run calls or they have blown exciting plays, that type of thing. They've given the wrong score. It just happens. And, you know, for me, you know, early on, that was part of my problem.
So what is your signature home run call now?
You know something, Marty? I really don't have one.
Really?
No, I really don't, because I think the really good home run calls are the ones that are originated spontaneously, where an announcer will just call a home run a certain way and say, wow, that was really good. And so to sit back and try to dream up, you know, wow, he will touch them all, it just sounds really phony and pretentious. And so I would rather just continue broadcasting, and maybe a good home run call will come to me. Most of the good ones are already taken. It's gone. And Dave Niehaus, my partner in Seattle, has It Will Fly Away. And a lot of these guys have the good home run calls. And what you're left with are these idiotic, goodbye, Mr. Baseball, those kind of calls. And I just don't want to have one of those.
Now, you were the announcer in a particular episode of The Simpsons, and this is when Homer was the dancing Homer, the mascot for the Springfield Isotopes. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. My partner David Isaacs and I wrote that episode, and they let me be the announcer.
Being a lifelong fan of baseball, did the game lose any of its luster when you got to see it up close and you got to see it behind the scenes?
Well, it did and it didn't. It did not, in the sense that for the first time I had a chance to travel to all of these great ballparks, to actually be in Fenway Park and Tiger Stadium and places that I had just seen my whole life on TV. That was magical. But on the other hand, yes, when you see the problems that baseball is undergoing, and I remember last year we were in Minnesota when Fay Vincent, the commissioner, was fired. And I said, you know, it's kind of like the Don McLean American Pie song, that this was the day that the game died. And there is that that cloud that hangs over the game. You don't know whether there will be a major lockout next year. You're not even sure if they're going to be playing next year. The headlines are consumed by dollars and the different contract problems and labor negotiations. And the big thing to me that has hurt the game is players jumping from team to team to team. It used to be, as a kid growing up, that you loved your team and you loved the players who were on your team. And kids could really get an attachment to certain players. They really had their heroes. And you can't do that much anymore. Now kids are pretty much rooting for the logos of the teams, because with the exception of like a George Brett or a Robin Yount, who have played their entire career with one team, these guys are bouncing around. Dave Winfield is with his fifth team. Jack Morris is probably with his fifth team in 2 years. I mean, these guys just go where the money is, and it really has changed the game.
Is that something you would talk about as an announcer?
Yes. Yes, I would talk about that on the air.
Do you have a favorite time at the ball field?
My favorite time at the ball field is just at the start of the game, when the folks are sort of settling in, when it is still dusk, when there is still some daylight left, a warm summer evening, the prospect of a ball game unfolding before you, that's really my favorite time.
Well, I want to talk some more, but we have to take a very short break. And my guest is Ken Levine, and he's written a book about his experiences as an announcer for the big leagues, and that's the major leagues. He started at the Baltimore Orioles. He's now an announcer for the Seattle Mariners. The book is called It's Gone, No Wait a Minute. And Ken Levine is an Emmy Award-winning writer and currently creative consultant for Cheers and Wings. Also, he was a head writer for MASH. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Ken Levine. Let's talk a little bit about the end of Cheers, and I don't want to make too much of this little segue here, but it seems a lot of baseball players don't know when to stop playing, and it's often painful to watch them struggle at the end of their career. I wonder if that's true for television shows as well.
Oh, I think that's very true. I think that's really an excellent analogy, and one of the reasons why Cheers has decided to leave at this point in time is because we didn't want to be essentially the show that came to dinner. We didn't want to overextend our welcome by a couple of years. And the tough thing is to keep coming up with fresh, interesting stories. And for Cheers, this will be 275 episodes in the can before it's all said and done. And that's quite a lot for any comedy show. And so I think there was that feeling to end the show now before the show gets stale, before the audience really gets tired of these people. We want it to go out on top.
You were involved in some of the beginning parts of Cheers. You were a co-producer 1982-83, is that right?
That's right, yeah. It was been very strange for me because Cheers has been an 11-year portion of my life, which is more than a quarter of my life. And to see it end is very weird, especially when I think back to those early days when we started out, most of the actors were unknowns. We were on NBC at a time when NBC was very close to just becoming a shopping channel, and nobody watched. We were kind of like an underground television show. We premiered for the week, and I think we were dead last. There was just no rating pull at all for Cheers, and yet we believed in what we were doing, and people were beginning to find the show. And it was kind of neat to be a part of, like I say, kind of an underground hit. It was a very exciting time.
Did you think it was good in the beginning?
Absolutely.
And it just needed to find an audience?
Absolutely. From day one, from the day I saw the pilot, I figured that this was something very special.
What did you see?
Well, I saw a show that, unlike most situation comedies, was really about characters and relationships. And it was also in such a warm, inviting setting. As a writer, having to spend sometimes 80 to 100 hours a week on staff, writing and rewriting and putting a show together, I think to myself, is this a setting that I want to spend time in? Do I want to be here? And the idea of a bar in Boston where folks would come together as kind of a sanctuary, to me, seemed very, very inviting.
Well, I think that's a lot of people's fantasy spot is a friendly corner bar. I think a lot of people would like that.
Yes, I think that everybody needs support, and especially the people who inhabit the Cheers bars, by and large, are losers. By and large, they've had flawed lives. And I think they really get comfort and strength in the support that they receive from each other. And I think that's so necessary. And I think, in a way, the audience, the television audience, has been invited in as well. You're part of that group.
How much do you think of that? The prickly conversations between Sam and Diane were a kind of a spin-off of some of the repartee between Hepburn and Tracy.
Well, the original creators, Glenn and Les Charles, envisioned that. They wanted to do a Hepburn-Tracy type of relationship. And so I think that was not by accident. I think two gifted actors in Ted Danson and Shelley Long were brought aboard, and they really provided, I think, the most important ingredient, and that is chemistry. Because without chemistry, the lines can be just razor sharp and very pithy, but they're just not going to hit the mark because the two people delivering the lines don't have a real attraction for each other. And I think the thing that was so great about Sam and Diane is that the audience really, really believed it.
Hmm. Was there a certain character that you had an affinity for, that you wrote for?
Yes, Frasier.
Frasier.
For some reason, I loved Frasier. Maybe it's because I have a degree in psychology at UCLA, and it's the only use I've ever been able to get out of it. But Frasier, to me, was kind of like an intellectual Daffy Duck. And he was a lot of fun to write for.
Well, I have to tell you that David Bianculli, who does TV reviews for Fresh Air, interviewed Kurt Vonnegut for his book. And Vonnegut told Bianculli that he would rather have written for Cheers than have written anything else in his life.
You know, I'm a big Kurt Vonnegut fan, and I heard about that last year, and I was astounded that he made that comment. And to me, as a television writer of Cheers, that is the greatest compliment I think I will ever receive in my life.
Was it hard, though? And I wonder, you're talking about a show that had to sustain itself for 11 years. I'm talking about it as if it's in its past tense, and we know that there's next week. But a show that really—
And it will live in reruns
forever. And it will always live on. Whether there were periods where it was really hard to sustain the characters. And, they never left the bar. You were limited by that particular room. And whether there was a low period during Cheers.
Well, there were certain story arcs that we experimented with that really didn't work through the course of the run of the show, you will see that we try certain things and then back off because it's experimental and, you know, you take your shot. There was a story runner that we had a few years ago where Rebecca was trying to get pregnant by Sam, that she wanted a baby. And that story arc really wasn't very successful. There was another one where Rebecca was being courted by a very young CEO. And we thought that might be kind of fun. And you do it for a couple of episodes and you say, no, that doesn't really work. And other times we brought in a character once for Frasier, a date, and her name was Lilith. And we thought it was kind of fun for a couple of jokes to have Frasier date another psychiatrist who was actually even more anal than him. And that turned into his wife, and it turned into a regular character. So you never really know. You just do your best. But there are periods of Cheers that we'd like back.
I wonder whether if Cheers were making its debut in 1993 and had its low first season, whether NBC or any other network would have stood by it?
Well, that's a real good question. When you look at some of the long-running comedy hits, a lot of them did not start out that well. The Mary Tyler Moore Show was not a ratings hit. MASH almost got canceled early on. And the same is true with Cheers, because it's the type of show that's not, quote, unquote, a breakout show. There is not a major star. It does not have the type of theme that is going to instantly draw people to the television set to watch it. It's a show that grows on you. It's kind of an acquired taste. And since there is a certain sophistication, and since it is a show that deals really more with characters and requires more of an investment of the audience, I think a show like Cheers takes longer to build. And if Cheers debuted in 1993 instead of 1982, I say there's a very good chance that it would have a tough time finding an audience for the first year.
What are your plans for the final episode on May 20th?
You're just gonna plans?
Yeah, you're going to do anything special?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the cast is all getting together at the Bull and Finch, which is the bar in Boston that Cheers was patterned after, and I'm going to be there, and it's going to be a great night, a big party, and then the Tonight Show is going to be filmed live from the Bull and Finch that night.
Well, I thank you very much, Ken Levine, for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Ken Levine has been a writer for MASH, Wings, and Cheers. His book about his introduction to Major League announcing is called It's Gone. No, Wait a Minute. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got. Taking a break from all your worries sure would help a lot.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. Filmmaker Ross McElwee has been called equal parts Samuel Beckett, Jean-Luc Godard, and Werner Herzog. His documentaries are often about the trials and tribulations of real life, usually his own. His 1986 film Sherman's March was about his quest for the meaning of romance. His new movie, Time Indefinite, shows a more mature McElwee exploring marriage, parenthood, and death. Also on today's show, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new movie, Posse, a Western about African Americans on the frontier. It was directed by Mario Van Peebles, whose last film was New Jack City. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Yugoslav lawmakers today endorsed a UN-backed peace initiative for Bosnia. Officials say the symbolic move is meant to show the way for Bosnian Serbs, who will determine the plan's fate in a weekend referendum. Meanwhile, the Muslim-led Bosnian government troops fought on two fronts today, in the north against Serbs and in the south against their former allies, the Croats. The United Nations condemned what it called the extremely serious violations of the five-day-old ceasefire by Bosnian Serbs. President Clinton defended his foreign and domestic policies in a wide-ranging news conference today. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from the White House.
President Clinton shrugged off public opinion polls that show his approval ratings lower than any other president this early in his term. "I'm trying to do hard things," Clinton said, "and I can't do hard things and conduct an ongoing campaign at the same time." But he pointed to the endorsement of his tax package by the House Ways and Means Committee and the recent passage of a bill that will make voter registration easier as signs that his administration is on track. He defended his policy in Bosnia, saying he was keeping up the pressure on the European allies to agree to his two-track approach, lifting the arms embargo on the Bosnian Muslims and using air power, if necessary, against the Serbs. And Mr. Clinton said he was considering sending U.S. peacekeeping troops to Macedonia. The president also said he supports a United Nations resolution to send U.N. troops to patrol the border between Serbia and Bosnia. But right now, there is no suggestion that the U.S. would contribute to that effort. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell predicts the tax bill approved yesterday by the House Ways and Means Committee will also be approved by the Senate, with most of its provisions intact. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The $246 billion tax plan is expected to win approval by the full House next week, but its future is less certain in the Senate. Its first test will come in the Senate Finance Committee, where Democrats outnumber Republicans by a narrow two-vote margin. The energy tax in the plan is unpopular, with some conservative Democrats on the panel who want to kill it. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, however, says they won't succeed.
I think the energy tax will survive in the Senate. I think it will be included in the final bill that's passed by the Congress and enacted into law.
Mitchell praised President Clinton for showing leadership on the tax issue, both to lawmakers and voters. Mitchell says the president has demonstrated he is more serious about wanting to cut the deficit than any president in recent years. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
In a suburban Paris nursery school, negotiations between police and an armed hostage taker have broken down. The gunman reportedly has asked not to be disturbed further until morning. Earlier, French authorities had provided ransom money and a getaway car demanded by the gunman. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 5 points today. You're listening to NPR News. A Detroit, Michigan judge has denied a request for a change of venue in the trial of the former police officers charged in the beating death of Malice Green in November of last year. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Malice Green died after being pulled over by police officers for questioning. An autopsy revealed that he suffered fatal blows to the head with a blunt object, possibly a police flashlight. Green was black. The three men charged in his death are white. Today, attorneys for two of the accused asked to have the trial moved out of Detroit. They said pretrial publicity has made it impossible for their clients to get a fair trial. One cited a survey commissioned by defense attorneys in which a large number of Detroit residents said they expected a riot if the officers are acquitted. Judge George Crockett III denied the request, saying an impartial jury can be found, but at the same time he did grant a request by one of the defendants to have a separate trial. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A racially mixed jury was seated today in Orlando, Florida, to hear the manslaughter trial of a Miami police officer in the killing of two black men. The six jurors include two Hispanics and one black. Colombian-born William Lozano is charged with two counts of manslaughter in the deaths of a black motorcyclist and his passenger. The killing set off three nights of racial violence in Miami in 1989. Attorney General Janet Reno said today the independent counsel is necessary to maintain public confidence in investigations of top federal officials. Reno testified today before the Senate Government Affairs Committee, which is considering reenacting the independent counsel law. The legislation was enacted following the Watergate scandal. It lapsed last year. National police say a car bomb was responsible for an explosion which shook a residential street in a wealthy neighborhood in Rome, Italy today. At least 14 people were injured. No one was killed. About a dozen cars were damaged on the fashionable street of restaurants and shops. The site is several miles from the Foro Italico. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Film critic Vincent Canby called Ross McElwee a filmmaker anthropologist with a rare appreciation for the eccentric details of our edgy civilization. In his 1986 documentary Sherman's March, McElwee went south after being jilted by a girlfriend to see if romantic love was still possible for him. His cinema verite style, his deadpan delivery, and his gift for getting others to talk about him and themselves made this film a hilarious and unblinkingly frank meditation on his own anxieties and emotional paralysis. His newest documentary picks up where Sherman's March left off. Time Indefinite begins with McElwee's announcement to his family at their yearly reunion that he's getting married. His family's concerns about his marital status had been a central theme in Sherman's March. Using his signature documentary style and his ironic personal commentaries, Time Indefinite explores the details, the pains, and the joys of family life. Ross McElwee's presence is felt in every frame of his films. I told him that to me, he comes off as a hapless, bumbling innocent.
I think if I came across as someone who was perhaps too much in control, the film would not be as interesting. I think what the film is about, and what my other films have been about, is this inability to control life and the fact that life is always bringing surprises on us and that things never work out the way we think they do. And to convey that that I have some way of controlling my destiny moment by moment by being completely in control of things, I think would not be as interesting. So that's something I consciously strive for. And of course, it is true to me and to what happened in my life. I couldn't control the things that happened in the film. And those are reflected in how the film turned out.
In the beginning of the film, you announce that you and Marilyn are going to be married. And just after your announcement, and the camera pans from Marilyn mm-hmm. to your father, mm-hmm. and just after the announcement, the battery goes dead.
Yes.
And the comment you have, and this is about your father, mm-hmm. you said he gives off this Freudian force field that plays havoc with my
yes.
equipment. Is this a comment on a kind of a lifelong relationship you had with him?
Well, I'd say so. It's my relationship with my father was always one of restrained respect for each other. I think he was certainly somewhat baffled by how I could expect to make a living at what I was doing. He never had any kind of judgment about filmmaking as a way of making a living. As long as one could do it, he felt if you can do it, fine. You didn't choose to do medicine is a career, but be sure to find something that you can support yourself with. And that was always his primary concern. And when my filmmaking turned out to be the kind of filmmaking that would use him in it, I think that it made things much more complicated. His bafflement attained a whole nother level. He didn't understand why I was filming him. And ironically, it was surprising how many times my equipment did malfunction when I was filming him. It was almost as if he enabled things to short circuit just by aiming a camera at him, just by looking at me a certain way. And I think that that's a kind of metaphor for how fathers and sons often end up regarding each other.
Well, did you find that filming him
got you closer to him or got you talking with him about what you were trying to do? Did it create a conversation you didn't have before?
Well, it gave us something to talk about, that's for certain. I think when he saw Sherman's march with an audience for the first time, he did finally understand what it was I was up to. And I'd shown him the film as a kind of family event. And it wasn't the same thing. It took seeing it in the context of an audience of strangers for him to realize that, in fact, I wasn't totally I wasn't totally insane, that in fact this kind of filmmaking would have something of an appeal to at least a limited audience out there. And I think he could appreciate that. And the other thing he said to me, which I'll never forget, was after this initial screening that he sat in, and there was a great deal of laughter throughout the film at the moments when people are supposed to laugh. And afterwards he said, "I never knew you were so funny, son."
Did he laugh?
Oh, yes, he laughed. My stepmother said he was laughing so hard he was weeping at one point. And I've never seen him laugh that hard, so I wished I'd actually seen that.
Well, Time Indefinite, as much as it has humorous, hilarious moments, is, it seems to me, a contemplation about death. And death really weaves its way into the story. Your wife, Marilyn, has a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. Your grandmother dies during the film. Your mm-hmm. father dies. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the fact that when you had a brother who was 11, he died, and that your mother died about, I guess, 10 years mm-hmm. after that. Mm-hmm. It makes me wonder whether when you're starting a film like this and then things like that happen, what happens to the intention of the filmmaker?
Well, that's part of the attraction of this kind of filmmaking. And also what's scary about it is that the films do reflect life. And in a way, it gains its strength, I think, from what can't be foreseen. And I'm not the only person making films like this. I think there's a whole history of cinema verite filmmaking that relied upon this element of the unpredictable. It surely makes it a lot harder to make the films and then to know how to complete them. I certainly didn't foresee the deaths that occurred and never dreamt that a major theme in my film would be on dealing with death. I thought it would be a pretty lighthearted treatment of what it's like for this particular person to get married in our society in this day and time and what it means to start a family if, you know, that happens. And that somehow a film would come out of that, but I never foresaw the turn that it took into, very real despair.
Well, at one point you say you were trying to, quote, corner death with a camera.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that you could use the camera that way?
Well, it was an attempt to do it, perhaps knowing all along that it's an impossible thing to do. It's a psychiatric conundrum. You can't believe in your own death, or you stop living, and it's almost impossible to picture your own death. And I think in some crude way, I was trying, by dealing directly with the deaths of people who were close to me, to somehow fix the notion of death, come to terms with it with the movie camera. And of course the attempt was doomed to failure, and perhaps rightly so. Maybe the best thing to do is to never accept people's deaths and simply to move on in life. And I think that that's what happens at the conclusion of the film. But yes, I mean, I think I did try to push that as far as I could, gathering photographic proof in a sense of fixing down death and trying to nail it somehow.
Well, I want to talk some more, but we have to take a very short break. And my guest today is Ross McElwee. He's a documentary filmmaker, and his 1986 film, Sherman's March, was basically, McElwee turned the camera on himself. It was a meditation on love and women. And his new film is called Time Indefinite, and it's what happened after Sherman's March. It's about his family, his marriage, the birth of his son. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee. You got money, a grant, to do Sherman's March, and originally you were going to follow the route that Sherman took during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. But after a girlfriend left you, you went south and filmed conversations with former girlfriends and some of the women that you met along the way.
That's right.
Did you imagine that you were actually making a film for anyone but yourself?
Well, no. I very much knew I was making a film for myself. And that was one of the decisions I had made much earlier, was to go ahead and make films that somehow reflected the particular vision that I had of the world, whatever that was, which is, I think, what, well, I won't speak, you know, for other filmmakers. It's certainly what I felt I had to do for myself in order to make something that I could be pleased with. And at the same time, I knew I had to make a film that would somehow have a place in the world, that to make a film purely about your own life and your own problems would not work, would not be of interest to anyone, unless it had some way of engaging an audience through any number of ways. And the ways I chose to make that work were by uses of humor, a humorous narration, and also by this odd parallel track, historical tract of General Sherman's march through the South. And somehow the mix seemed to work for most people anyway. And I could both thereby make a film for myself and also for an audience out there, and that turned out pretty well.
Well, part of the film is you looking for a woman and members of your family and other people trying to fix you up with someone.
Yes.
Did you get a lot of marriage proposals after that film came out?
Well, I got some inquiries. I wouldn't say I got formal marriage proposals. They don't come in writing anymore.
No.
I think. I certainly got a lot of letters, but, you know, ironically, most of the letters that I got were not about my availability, but were about how do I make a film like this about my own life? People mm-hmm. wanted to know. I want to make a film like this. And I thought that was a very interesting phenomenon, that it had struck a chord somewhere in a large number of people out there who were really curious about this way of making films and saw their own lives as being equally interesting, which, of course, I think, is true. Anybody's life, when looked at it a certain perspective, is infinitely fascinating if it can be rendered in some form that makes it accessible to other people through, you know, literature or through film or art. I mean, there's something about the everydayness, the mundanity of our lives that, you know, when viewed somewhat obliquely and given a twist or a turn, become something of universal interest.
Were you ever embarrassed about putting anxieties, your own anxieties, insecurities on film? Did you ever want to take anything back?
Well, the truth of the matter is that when I first made Sherman's March, I did not insert the segments that I had filmed of myself confessing my anxieties to the camera, because I felt I've gone over the deep end, and this is something you don't do in films, and I made a mistake when I shot that stuff. I didn't even process it for close to a year after I shot the film, but I kept cutting the film and cutting it and realized it just wasn't working. Voiceover narration wasn't enough. I actually need to step in front of the camera and appear in it just as other people have. And so I finally processed those scenes, those little monologues, and reluctantly showed them to close friends, and they said, yes, this is what the film's been missing. This is what pulls it together. And after that, I got over my camera shyness. I went ahead and put in all the scenes that I'd shot, and they worked.
Well, I think there's something about a camera, maybe it's the person behind the camera, mm-hmm. that makes people want to confess. And I don't know whether it's like meeting someone at an airport you've never met before, and after 20 minutes you've told them everything about your life.
Yes.
But there's something about a camera. Maybe it's just the sort of anonymous mechanical aspects of it.
I think there's some truth to that. I think there is this odd way in which psychiatrists and cameras have become the confessional icons of our age, whereas, you know, before it was the church, the priest. I think, you know, people have said that about psychiatry. Well, I think it's also true about cameras. And there is this way in which confessing things to the camera, confiding things, I would say, would be a better verb, is definitely something that comes remarkably easy to a number of people, including myself.
Are you patient?
Oh, you have to be. Patience is one of the absolute necessities for this kind of filmmaking, which is also why it's not for everybody. I think we're in a... film and television has, in fact, stressed the opposite qualities, a kind of impatience with the visual image as witnessed, as has been said many times, with MTV, but also with everything, television commercials, and even the way major motion pictures are cut, there's a kind of impatience, an inability to linger and absorb, which you know, produces some interesting work. I'm willing to let a shot run for 2 minutes without edits, and to give people a chance to absorb the cadences of what someone's saying and their body language, and not simply the verbal content or the way in which someone slices open a watermelon and hands out the pieces of the fruit to a child, rather than simply, you know, a quick 5-second shot. I mean, this kind of patience, I think, is something I'm very interested in.
I've read a number of quotes about how you film, and I wonder whether you have a different relationship with your camera now. In Sherman's March, you said, "I'm filming my life in order to have a life to film." Mm-hmm. And in your latest documentary, Time Indefinite, you say, "It's hard to film my life and live my life mm-hmm. at the same time." Are you in some conflict about that?
Oh, of course. It's it's a primal conflict for anybody who would undertake to film one's own life. And it's pretty much unresolvable. And in fact, that unresolvable quality becomes a theme in the film. But its broader implications, I think, are more universal. You think about the fact that most of us have to work for a living, and how do we separate our work from the time that's important to spend with people we care about, friends, lovers, wives, children, husbands. That's a very essential question that we're all dealing with, unless, you know, you happen to be lucky enough to have a trust fund and you don't have to go to work every day. But, of course, beyond that, for those people who are misdriven enough to think they have to make their livelihoods as artists, it becomes problematical trying to decide over and over again, do I render this as life, or do I render it and simply live it, or does it have to become part of my art?
Well, that reminds me of a scene in Time Indefinite where you and Marilyn have moved to a different, a bigger apartment, and she says, if you put that camera down, you could help.
Yes.
And the idea being, we got lots of boxes here to unpack, and I thought it was an interesting admonishment to you.
Absolutely, and it's meant to be perceived as that. That's always the dilemma. And with writing, if you were writing a novel based upon your own life, you would at least have that ability to store something in your mind and come back to it later on in front of the word processor and put it into your novel. If you're writing a fiction film, you can make notes and later write it into a script, and it can be true to that experience. But with this form of documentary filmmaking, it's either get it as it's happening or forget it. It's gone. And therein also is, you know, a metaphor about life, and that life is fleeting and you have to take advantage of it as it happens. So what happens when the two come head to head? That's part of the conflict of this kind of filmmaking. And it's, I think, what gives an interesting tension to the films as you watch them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure being on your show.
Documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee's film is called Time Indefinite. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the news today. Robert, what stories will you be covering?
Well, we'll be hearing about President Clinton's news conference at which he defended his leadership in the face of a lot of editorial comment and polls showing that people don't think he's doing quite as good a job as he was a couple of months ago. He says he's accomplished quite a bit and has actually led as well on policy toward Bosnia, which is one of the question marks. Also, we'll be hearing today about plans to encrypt, that is, have encryption codes for computers to prevent hackers from getting in, and the problems that idea has had with the government. Also, the history of the apartment building in New York and the Malagasy music group Tariqa Sammy.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie Posse is a revisionist Western directed by and starring Mario Van Peebles, who also made New Jack City. Screenwriter and actor Cy Richardson based Posse's story on the lives of his grandfathers, both black cowboys. Kevin Whitehead, who usually reviews jazz for us but is also a movie maven, is filling in for the next couple of weeks for Stephen Schiff, who's at the Cannes Film Festival. Kevin has a review of Posse.
African Americans have had such a low profile in Westerns. A movie seemed progressive if it had one black cast member. usually played by bald-headed Woody Strode. But blacks made up one-third of the settlers in the Old West, as a character played by Strode explains at the beginning of Posse. Mario Van Peebles' film does a great job of being both mythic and educational. If you love westerns, you'll like Posse a lot. It plays with familiar plot lines and images, and it invokes those visual clichés that make westerns westerns. A window shutter noisily flaps in the breeze on a quiet street. A mother drags her child indoors as menacing strangers ride into town. Posse deals with a handful of righteous renegades, led by Van Peebles' strong, silent Jesse Lee. His companions include filmmaker Charles Lane as Wheezy, a squeaky know-it-all in the Spike Lee vein, rapper Big Daddy Kane as a slick gambler, and token good white guy Stephen Baldwin. Our heroes are being pursued by an insane army colonel, played by Billy Zane. You know Zane and Van Peebles will eventually square off, if only because they're the two prettiest guys in the West. But Posse also helps set the historical record straight. It mostly takes place in the hamlet of Freemanville. Its citizens include Isaac Hayes, Nipsey Russell, and actor-director Melvin Van Peebles, Mario's father. Freemanville is typical of towns which were founded by blacks out west, but later forced out of existence as property values escalated. In that sense, Posse's kind of a horseback remake of Chinatown. We get the point in this conversation between Jesse Lee and Freemanville's sheriff, played by Blair Underwood.
How about you, partner? You run from the army?
I reckon you could say that.
Run from the law.
Well, it depends on whose law you're talking about. You talking about the law they got for them, or that law they got for us?
You know you still ain't changed, boy, but the world has. Ain't that black and white no more, Jesse. Soon, the West is gonna be settled. Ain't gonna be no more new frontier or frontiers, man. We got business, my friend, and businessmen. You see, listen, no, Jesse, no. See, once all the land is full up, Jesse, listen to me, the land. See, once it's full up, the only thing that can change is who's got the land and who don't.
Posse may be good for you, but it's an audience picture. It's great looking, very funny, and has enough action to sustain a Saturday double feature. It's also been edited so aggressively it can give you whiplash. Posse gets away with its frantic pace because its characters and plot are part of every moviegoer's shared heritage. Generic elements are used like sampled music on a rap record. If the source is familiar enough, you only have to hear a couple of bars to get the point. And like sampling, this use of stock ingredients is an act of appropriation, a reminder these stories belong to African Americans too. Unfortunately, women are relegated to the same old secondary roles, but give Van Peebles credit for making an action movie without a rape scene. At the end of the story, Woody Strode's character gives an heirloom to two young reporters played by the Hudlin brothers, the filmmakers who brought us House Party. It's a symbolic gesture. African Americans need to move from in front of the camera to behind it, because that's the only way movies like Posse will get made. After this, those all-white westerns will never seem the same.
Kevin Whitehead is a critic based in New York. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell. Our engineers are Audrey Vablaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Chris Fraley. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Jeff Bridges. He starred in The Last Picture Show, Jagged Edge, Tron, The Fisher King, and The Fabulous Baker Boys. His new movie is American Heart. Join us for the next Fresh Air.